And then the players had to decide, were they going to kill these nice, sweet dogs or let them live?
Welcome to the Rickhouse Podcast, a podcast where we dip our caps into the blood of our listeners and we ramble on about old school games. In today's episode, we are welcoming Chris Goneman back to the podcast. And we're going to talk a bunch about Iron Falcon, some of the new products that have come out, and just have a nice little chat. So as always, remember, no mortal can do it in a recap. So I hope you sit back, listen, and enjoy. Chris Goneman was on a short while ago, and it was easily one of the most popular episodes we've had on the podcast. Super happy to have him come back and talk about some of the new books that have just recently got released. So without any further preamble, let's just get right to the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, your podcasting app has not glitched. Chris Goneman has returned. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing good.
Thanks very much for coming back. It's been a little bit since last time we chatted, but I hope everything went well. You survived American Thanksgiving?
Yes. Quite well as usual.
Yeah. For me up here in Canada, we don't partake really in American Thanksgiving, but for my work, it's always nice and quiet because everybody from the States is off. So I almost get a mini vacation because everybody from the US is off. So it's great.
Yes.
We had a lot, actually, of really good feedback from the last time you were on. So it's great to have you back on. This one, we get to reveal a couple of the secrets that we talked or hinted about last time we chatted.
The secrets are kind of out now in the public, yeah. I want to talk about what I've got out there. The things I was being cagey about last time. How do you want to proceed with this?
Yeah, Santa Goneman and all of his elves have brought forth new material to the world. One of them I have in my physical hands. The other one is in the mail on its way to me, but I have the digital copy of it. Let's start with the new stuff from Iron Falcon. Last time we chatted a bunch about Basic Fantasy, let's chat about what's new in Iron Falcon.
Well, for starters, I mean, the Handbook of Monsters.
Yes.
Which I've been talking about for some time. And I think maybe we discussed this in the previous podcast, but I'll just kind of go over it again. The purpose of the handbook is to fill in all the blanks. One of the things I discovered after creating Iron Falcon was that having 1975 as a target coverage date left me with a lot of monsters that we think of as classic, that we think were always there, that were missing. Things that you think have always been part of the game since the very beginning. Well, it was only a year into it. Some of them hadn't been invented yet. The number one thing, the first thing that bit me was shriekers, so to speak. They don't actually bite, but there were no shriekers. I mean, how do you have a classic dungeon without sticking a shrieker here and there just to mess things up? But they weren't in the books because they had not been invented yet. Or if they had, they hadn't been published at any rate in 1975 target date of the game. And as I wrote adventures, as I particularly did the adventures for Iron Falcon Adventures 1, which was the adventure book that was out for a while. It came out practically with the game in the beginning. I had to actually fill in blanks. I had to create these monsters and fill them in as one-offs and so forth. And I realized going forward that I needed to have a better source of these monsters, a source I could cite and use, an OGL covered source. And I realized if I needed that, so did everybody else do in 0E era games. So I created the Iron Falcon Handbook of Monsters. And I filled in all the blanks. I basically aimed at roughly 1982 to have just about every monster that was in print at that time for the world's most popular role-playing game to cover that. And that was the goal of the handbook. So it's not a sexy book. It's not full of a whole bunch of monsters you've never seen before.
No, it'll be very familiar to anybody who's looked through the field guide for Basic Fantasy or the core book for Basic Fantasy. A lot of the same monsters are in there. The layout's very similar. Smatterings of art here and there. But it is really nice to kind of have them all statted out in a way that's consistent with the game that it's being targeted at.
Exactly.
Have to remove all that conversion work.
There are creatures in there that aren't in Basic Fantasy, that aren't in the field guides. There are creatures in there that I forgot existed in 1982 that I went back and looked and I'm going, huh, how come I've never seen stats for that monster? And, you know, they're in there. There are Very few novel monsters in there, though. For the monsters that were covered by the OGL that I could actually just use straight up, I used them straight up. For the monsters that were claimed as product identity, I tried, like everybody does who creates OGL games, I created monsters to fill the same ecological niches as best as possible within the limits of product identity. And then there were monsters that, as I say, had never been brought forward. Nobody ever claimed and nobody ever did anything with. And two specific monsters that were not in any of those books at the time, Red Caps, which was the one contribution I took from an outside contributor. I was R. Kevin Smoot, one of the guys who's one of the original guys in basic fantasy development, supplied those. And I had to have Mushroom Men because I had Alexander Cook do an artwork, and Al does such nice Mushroom Men. I just had to have them. But there's not a lot of novel monsters. It's not intended to be a book where you get a whole bunch of new ideas. It's intended to be a book where you find all the old ideas.
Yeah, and one thing I really like, I always appreciate whenever I go into a monster book, bless you, is if in there is a index that helps me build out my encounter in terms of like, okay, I'm in the desert. What's the easiest way for me to go and find all the monsters in this book that have something to do with the desert? And so like you can flip to the back here and there's a nice index and you can do the roll percentage. But for me, I often use this just as a way to keep
together. I'll warn you that those tables are probably not as comprehensive as I'd like them to be. I made every effort to try to cover everything I felt would work, but I know there are things that I probably should have had in there that I didn't. And it's also true that probably about this time next year, there'll be a revised edition coming out with a little more detail filled in there. I don't really intend to ever add any monsters. I don't think I ever need to. Much like basic fantasy, I had a coverage target for this. It was a bigger coverage target than usual. But I had a coverage target for this, and once I covered it, I don't plan on doing any more that way. But there's lots of tweaks and adjustments that can be made along the way, and that's going to happen. But I wanted to get the book out there, partly because Christmas is coming, and partly because it was time. You know, it was to that point, I feel like.
Yeah, it's always good to have, I think with every game system, it's good to have, you know, enough that you can start the game in the core rule books and then eventually expand on it, because everybody always needs to have additional monsters. And it's not like monsters are difficult for the most part for people to convert, but it's the convenience of having them all in one spot.
And
done.
To some extent, I think the handbook is really a publication tool as much as it is a game book that you use at the table that allows people writing adventures to have a source to get monsters from for their adventures so that they can do a proper old school adventure and cover everything they need to cover, fill in all the monsters that they need, whatever monsters it is that they need or whatever era or edition of the old days they're aiming at, it should all be there.
Speaking of adventures, I mean, you also released a couple of new adventures combined in one book, which is really unique. Iron Falcon 75 was the other new product that came out. I read through it and I went, because I didn't know what to expect. I hadn't followed anything that you may have mentioned a bit before what you talked about in the podcast. So whenever I saw the book, I went, oh, this is so cool.
We never talked about it. It was, although I have run public sessions, I always ask everybody who was involved in those public sessions to not talk about it online, because once it's online, it's everywhere.
Right.
And I've run them at convention games. I've run play tests with my in-person group and play tests with my online group. And it's always a blast. I mean, I of all the stuff that I've ever written, I've never written anything that plays like Iron Falcon 75 does.
But before we go too much further, for anybody who has not seen the book or has not seen the announcement, Iron Falcon 75, I'll say what my synopsis is.
Well, I'm going to pause you right there.
Okay.
Folks, this is about to be a spoiler alert. If you think you might ever play as a player in an Iron Falcon 75 game, come back to Kevin's podcast in a year or two after you've played some and you can hear us talk about it. But you don't want that. You don't want these secrets. You don't want us to tell you these things in advance, because they are just finding out in the game is just so much more fun.
That is
now true, for those of you who might be running the game. Here we go.
Yeah. So DMs only. I agree there. Iron Falcon 75. You're playing yourself in 1975 in our modern world, and then weirdness happens and magic becomes real again, and you, as you know, Joe Smith, living in whatever small town you live in, discover that there's magic about, and you speak, you can enter essentially, I likened it to plane shifting, but I know you use what's it called, the shadow realm, the shadow, how did you word it?
It is the shadow realms. It is intentionally as vague as I can make it. It's not supposed to be something that the players or even the game master immediately understands. It should always be mysterious. The moment that it becomes commonplace and they traipse in and out all the time, it's a lot of the fun goes out of it. It should always be a little hairy.
But I found it interesting a minute ago there, you said that you've played as a conventionist, because as I was reading through this, especially when I got to the end of the book where you've got the character sheets and the little background cards that are in that book, the first thing that came to my head, I was like, this would play really well at a convention. I was like, even just those little cards just screamed convention game to me, of how that was set up. So I don't know if that was deliberate, why those are included, but that's really, I was like, oh yeah, this could just be picked up and taken to a convention and played, to be pretty straightforward.
I could have spent 100 pages explaining to a game master how to create a starting scenario like that. Or I could spend 10 pages, 20 pages creating that starting scenario. And if the game master wants to do something different, I've provided a template. I've provided a way to proceed. And in fact, we're talking about an alternative start, which an alternative way to start this game, which we'll talk about in a little while here. Because that's future development. This is just current stuff. But yeah, the first level of the adventure, the players, for those who are listening, the players actually choose which stereotypical kid they were in grade school, who would have played role-playing games or war games, because we're that far back. The fat kid, the brainy kid, the weird kid, and the poor kid, as the standard options. And for any group that can actually muster more than four players, we have the visiting kid and the popular kid. All of these kids are provided, and the players are expected to choose from them. And in some cases at a convention game, the players are expecting they're going to play as kids in a Goonies type an adventure, but that's not the idea at all. The intro cards actually say what happened when they grew up. The fat kid loses weight and gets buff in high school and becomes a football player. The brainy kid goes on to become an accountant. The poor kid ends up in jail as a criminal and is on parole at the beginning of the adventure. And the weird kid ends up a priest or cleric of your choice. The game is not really picky about exactly what kind of religion you follow, but it's just easier to write pseudo Christian sort of Catholic as a basic story. But the game master can go anywhere, and the players can go any way with that they want to. But that's the deal. And the thing about it that I discovered is that Iron Falcon 75 is way more immersive than any game I've ever run, because the players, even though 1975 was a long time ago for some of my players, before their birth for a few of them. I mean, I got a lot of old players, but they're not as old as me. 1975 was a long time ago, but yet it's still the modern age. They can imagine being those people. And I have tried to give guidance in how to introduce NPCs in a situation where the player characters have known those NPCs for all of their lives. They grew up in the same small town together. And so they're introduced a few at a time, and the players are made to understand that they've known these people forever, whether they liked them or didn't like them, whether the people liked them or didn't like them, whatever kind of relationship they might have had. It becomes much more immersive. The players take those NPCs much more seriously than they do some random medieval person on the streets of Slateholm, for example.
Right. Well, as somebody who grew up in a small town, it's easy to kind of read through that and go, okay, I see what you're going for. And then immediately have my brain go, all right, so if I was going to set this in my hometown, these would be the type of NPCs I'd have. This would be the places that people would go. Like, so it's very instantly relatable to a lot of people. You're completely correct that even though it's 1975, I mean, that's pre-me, that's before I was born. It's still recognizable enough that, you know, everybody's seen enough movies. If you weren't alive then, you've seen the movies, or even if you didn't, you can imagine enough, like it's not that far back. But it's also conveniently not so modern that there's a bunch of other stuff that you would have to deal with as complications to how adventures could run. Like you get to skip.
I'll admit that that was a factor. One of the interesting things, and you can have your political opinion about this if you want to, but one of the interesting things is the player characters are immediately going to want guns.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I had to provide in the game, I had to provide some rules for things that the players are going to encounter, and one of them is guns. Who is going to go up against zombies and not take a shotgun?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that you included, the rules for that, because and not so much because it doesn't make sense for the setting, it completely makes sense for it, but more so that guns in RPGs, especially D&D or that era of gaming, has always been so everybody and their dog has 16 different ways of doing that and different ways for those systems to work. So I was kind of curious how yours work. It makes complete sense how it is. It's just pretty straightforward on the damage and everything. But it's one of those things that everybody has tried to implement, but I haven't seen it often done where it makes sense because the world that you're playing in is there. It's more usually people trying to bring gunpowder to fantasy.
Right. One of the difficulties with a game like Iron Falcon in general is the level of abstraction it operates at makes bringing in modern things like guns rather complicated. If you want to, you can't be simulationist and try to simulate them accurately. It really won't work because the game doesn't simulate anything else accurately. So it's simulating more of a genre of fiction than it is simulating a real era. And that I kept that firmly in mind as I was creating those rules for firearms and for other modern conveniences that the players might have, like flashlights. Awful darn handy things. Although flashlights in the 1970s actually kind of sucked. So one of the things I remember from living through the 1970s, the flashlights sucked. The ones now are so much nicer.
Yeah, they didn't really have LED.
No. You always had
bulbs or whatever.
You always had a dim ring around the light wherever it was aiming. You always had a hard time aiming it so you could really see good. I remember watching the first season of Stranger Things, and they're walking through the woods with what are obviously not period appropriate flashlights. And I'm like, yeah, no, you couldn't see that good in the dark. Not back then.
I remember thinking of flashlights from whenever I was a kid. We used to have these little ones that they weren't long cylinder ones. They weren't like police flashlights with long cylinder ones. They were almost like a handheld with a little tiny light on the front of it. And they were garbage. We used to get those all the time for when we went for camps and stuff. It was just brutal.
They're terrible. Useless. But even so, flashlights do have their conveniences. Much like magic lighting, they don't light things on fire. Of course, that's also a downside. They don't light things on fire when you need them to. So, but that's all detail. Basically, the object of creating the rules we had to have was to fill in the things we had to have. There's also a few pages of rules that are optional. One of the downsides of classic games like Iron Falcon is how easily first level characters die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not a downside, in my opinion, when you're running that game. You expect a high death rate. You celebrate the characters that survive to second level and so forth. But when your characters are so deeply embedded in their world.
Yeah, if you have half your neighborhood die off.
We had a player character die in our online game, and it was a significant event. It made the news. There was a funeral. The player character who had tormented this other player character's family members had to make nice with them. the poor kid had not been nice to the weird kid's family and had to make nice. And so that was the weird kid, the priest, it was actually the one that died in the online game.
Yeah, the optional rules were
ones heroically,
the optional rules were actually a couple of things I took notes on because there was two of them that jumped out as really interesting to me. One was the hit points that we were just talking about. The player gets their con as their hit points, and it gets added to incrementally as they level up, which I think also really feeds into the whole. This works really well as a con game because a level one character is automatically starting with enough hit points that they can survive an encounter or two pretty easily. And then the second optional rule that I thought was really cool in there was the doubles and triples rule as a basically a different way of handling crits in a way.
Yes, yes. I tried that rule in a non-class and level game some years ago. I tried a rule like that. It worked really well. It didn't require any math that I couldn't handle because I am really bad at math. It worked really well for the players. It doesn't happen very often. They celebrate it just as much as a crit when it does happen. And so I thought that also helps a little bit make firearms more fearsome with characters that have more hit points. You don't have that situation where a character just gets shot once and dies like in a TV show or movie like you'd expect, unless you also have a doubles and triples rule where it can occasionally happen.
Right.
And that's a lot of what's going on there.
The other, so we've got firearms in the game, which is interesting and cool. But I got to say, as I went through the book, my favorite thing as far as new items, so to speak, was a chainsaw. So there is a chainsaw in this game, folks, because of course there's zombies. And if you want to have a fight against a zombie, if you don't have a chainsaw, what are you even doing with your life? But one of the cool things about the chainsaw, as far as the mechanics and how it worked, was there's a secret roll that the DM does before the person buys the chainsaw, which basically sets how reliable it is. And so you figure out, you do a roll and you're like, okay, this chainsaw starts 35% of the time, fails to start 35% of the time. And person goes to start it and they have to do a check and they don't know what that number is. I'm sure they will quickly deduce what it is over a few times of trying to start it, but it adds an interesting little thing there. But the chainsaw is also pretty brutal on how it's used. It's a little bit sloppy, but also deadly. I thought it was great. I thought it was just a fantastic implementation of it.
I have to admit that rule's not that's feature is not play tested as much as I would have expected. People seem to prefer shotguns over chainsaws. Chainsaws
are nice,
but well, the thing about it is with a shotgun, you don't have to get near as close and you don't usually get as much on you. So, you know, those are factors. Nothing like going home with zombie all over your clothes.
That's true. That's true. There's a section of DM advice, like you were saying, where you talk through how to set up NPCs and everything else that's in there. The game still requires you to have an understanding of, like, have the rules for Iron Falcon, or you could essentially play this with probably almost any of that era type, any games that are trying to model after that era of adventure games. But yeah, you have to have the rules for Iron Falcon, and then you combine it with the optional rules from Iron Falcon 75, and you've got a very distinct experience.
There's absolutely no reason why it couldn't be played with Basic Fantasy.
Yeah,
but it would require some adaptation on the part of the game master to use Basic Fantasy's rules instead of Iron Falcon's. You'd have to go through and make quite a few adjustments. Nothing serious, nothing that an experienced game master couldn't do on the fly, but there's definitely things that would have to be changed. I liked the way it played as an add-on to Iron Falcon, though. I really felt like it was an interesting game played that way.
Yeah, I think the simpler, like even just the dice that you're using being a little bit simpler and depending on which in Basic Fantasy would be one option, but if you went with any of the other games, it can become more complex, and it just almost takes away from it may take away from the vibe that you're trying to go for of like that the cool new experience of playing in the era that you're playing in.
Sure. But that's the thing with, and I'll tell you, I've told the story before, but in my online game, one of the situations, I guess before I digress, I'll go back and cover a little bit I haven't covered. And we're still in spoiler country, of course. The game provides two different ways to interact with the magical environment. One is the various kinds of magical areas you might pass into, places that were pushed out of the world when magic went away and that are now, for one reason or another, returning. The very first adventure involves the accidental release of a dungeon in the basement of the hobby shop, and the subsequent capture of the hobby shop owner, who is Uncle Frank, the uncle of one of the player characters. And that's the actual objective of the very first adventure, is to descend into the first level of the dungeon and rescue Uncle Frank. Using only the equipment you're able to acquire by looting basically Uncle Frank's apartment and the hobby shop, because you can't leave the hobby shop once you're in it at the beginning of that adventure. That works fantastic as a convention game. The other way to interact with the magic is once there are magical zones established in the real world, creatures that were too magical disappeared. When magic disappeared, the creatures went away. The dragons mostly just went. For example, they were pushed out into shadow and became trapped in a timeless environment, like suspended animation. But any creature sufficiently close to human or a mundane animal became human or a mundane animal. The centaurs and the nymphs and so forth just became human. And with the return of magic, people who have no idea that their bloodline goes back into monsters somewhere may suddenly become monstrous. We've had your minotaurs running through.
Yeah, your mom could accidentally become a kobold.
In this case, we actually had minotaurs running around town. When the young woman that had been a classmate of, well, been a little older than some of the player characters, but they all knew her. And they encounter her downtown. The next thing they know, she's a minotaur and she's rampaging through the town. And they're like, they know who she is. They don't want to kill her. And not to mention the fact that she's tougher than they are at that point. And so there's a whole scenario where they have to decide what to do in each of these situations. There is a man in town who has these two lovely, sweet, large dogs who are actually hellhounds. In one of the play tests where the hellhounds manifested themselves, they actually killed their owner before the players were able to subdue them. The players took them out of town and they resumed being dogs. And then the players had to decide, were they going to kill these nice, sweet dogs or let them live, knowing that they might turn into hellhounds if they were exposed to magic again? And it was one of the most serious discussions of anything like that I ever heard in a game. I think there were players that were close to tears. I just sat back and waited to let them make their own decision as to how they wanted to proceed. And they did make a decision eventually, but and it was bad for the dogs. But but it really is. The game has a way of being much more immersive than other fantasy role-playing games because it presents a world that is familiar to the players. They're already familiar with the consequences and they think about them.
Yeah, it can really solve that typical GM question of like, how do I stop my players from being murder hobos? Well, if you kind of set this in a place where they understand what's going, like where they can relate to it a little bit more, suddenly there's a little bit more of a moral quandary there for people to play through. And there's an option. People listening might be like, oh, okay. So if your neighbor's dogs can turn into hellhounds and, a friend might turn into a minotaur, can the players themselves turn in? You've got rules in there for that too, where
I do.
It's rare, but it's possible for I walk into an area of magic and maybe I turn into a dwarf. It's done in a way that, you know, there's a chance of it happening, but it's not guaranteed. And it solves that question when it inevitably rises up in the game.
And it's handled in a way that the player character is not involuntarily transformed. Well, the player is not forced to accept the transformation that they didn't ask for. I think that's wrong. I think it's a bad idea to force a player character into a change like that, or change like that if the player doesn't want it. But if the player asks about it, there should be a chance, and the chance is inflated somewhat. It's more likely than it would probably be in the quote unquote real world, because if the player wants it, there should be a better chance than that.
Right.
But at the same time, I didn't want everybody in the party turning into elves all of a sudden. That just sounded silly. So, you know, it should be rare, but not impossible.
So Iron Falcon 75 launched. It's come out. It's available in print. Is it available in PDF yet? I didn't notice if it was.
It is not available as a PDF yet. I'm planning on releasing both the Handbook of Monsters and Iron Falcon 75 as free PDF sometime in the first quarter of next year. I do make a profit on these things. Unlike Basic Fantasy, which is a fully collaborative project, I do make a profit on these things. And I want to sweep up a little bit of that before I start giving away for free. But I am still committed to sharing. I'm still a big believer in sharing, and it is my intention. I'll release the handbook first, and then after a month or two, I'll probably, past that point, I'll release the Iron Falcon 75, because I do want them out there. A little while this way first. Whenever I'm able to get them on DriveThruRPG, I will be selling PDFs. But DriveThruRPG is insanely slow to set things up on, and frustrating, very, very frustrating to work with. So I'm you know, doing that as they will support. Meanwhile, they're available on Lulu and Amazon. Amazon being the usual people's usual preference, but some of my international customers, as it were, friends who buy basic fantasy stuff overseas, sometimes they tell me Amazon shipping is cheaper. Sometimes they tell me Lulu shipping is cheaper. So I give them both options. They can have whatever they want.
Yeah. My preference is always Amazon, simply because I've got Prime here in Canada. So it's easy. And I'm one of the filthy people who probably spends an abnormal amount of my purchasing goes through that website. Now, so
I'm going to tell you a couple of things that are possible future developments. This is all stuff that I'm looking at, because this is basically my problem right now. Somebody asked me if Iron Falcon 75 was like supposed to be complete. Oh, heck no. I'm not nearly done with Iron Falcon 75. I'm just starting. I have two adventures in mind and partially very sketchily written down at this point. One of them is The House on Mockingbird Hill, which is slightly horror themed, maybe. It definitely involves the same basic themes. It's intended to be a little bit higher level, probably third, fourth level at least, for the player characters. The opponents will be a little more obviously opponents, more of a challenge. House on Mockingbird Hill, though, also addresses a serious gap in Iron Falcon 75. The monsters that we're accustomed to, the monsters that we see in fantasy role-playing games, are primarily from European mythological sources, with some African and some Asian sources thrown in, but predominantly European. There's very little in the way of New World influences in any of that stuff. And yet here we have adventures that are taking place in the New World. Well, so the monsters and the locations are literally imported for the base Iron Falcon 75. They are the things the colonists brought with them, whether they intended to or not, from the Old World. But House on Mockingbird Hill has a Native American aspect to it. And for me to do that, I'm an old fat white guy. I'm going to have to find me a collaborator preferably somebody with a Native American with some Lakota ancestry and some decent knowledge of the material, to collaborate with me, somebody who can work 50-50 with me. It literally, House on Mockingbird Hill literally melds the European and New World mythology. So it basically takes somebody on both sides of the aisle to put it together. So if you're out there listening and you find yourself described by what I just described, let me know. I am looking for a collaborator. There will be a sharing of profits on it and credit on it with whoever steps forward. We'll work out details on that if there's somebody out there that wants to work on a project like that. The second one is called The Lost Kingdom. The Lost Kingdom is very traditional. It is definitely a situation where the player characters are walking into another world. And it's a series of adventures set in a kingdom, an entire kingdom that was pushed out of the world into shadow, and that is tenuously connected to the real world. So it's a fantasy take on Land of the Lost, if you will. And that's one I'm also looking forward to. I have some very good concrete ideas on it. I've play tested some of the parts of it, if that makes sense, in an entirely different game, but not put it all together yet. So those are things that are planned. There was a suggestion on the forum that is rapidly becoming a possibility for an alternative Iron Falcon 75 start where the player characters are all college students. And in a college that has something odd going on in its steam tunnels. Now, the basis of this is not the tragic real world story, but the fictionalized version that became
that caused panic,
the core of the satanic panic, and added into that elements that might be recognizable from other satanic panic sources, particularly the evil sorceress and her allies who start out as members of the wargaming club in this college and then break off on their own because they're just too weird for everybody else. There's some definite ideas going on there. The person that I'm looking at collaborating with and I have not really had a complete meeting of the minds on it yet. Hell, for all I know, it might end up becoming two completely different adventures. I don't know, but it would be an alternative start for an Iron Falcon 75 campaign. I've considered the possibility, since if you've looked at IF-75, you know that there is an adventure at the end that is really separate from the other stuff. The Ghost Tower of Lakeside is separate from the other stuff. I've considered dropping House on Mockingbird Hill, which is probably not going to be as big as the Iron Falcon 75 book, at the end of another alternate start type of an adventure. So there'd be something in there for everybody, regardless of which start they chose to use. You could even mix a party out of members from both starts after the game was in progress. So,
yeah, the way that the whole thing is set up, once you've got a start, whether or not you're using these kind of really cool seeds that you guys have come up with in both Iron Falcon 75 and what you're describing there, I love the idea of having the steam tunnel. Call it that thumbs up on that. But
it's the kind of a terrible idea that needs to be written.
Yes, it's already there. You can almost just crib the movie. But the
definitely won't be doing that.
But the way that the shadow is described, at least whenever I read it, I went, oh, this can be used to go anywhere. Like you can enter this and play any scenario you want. From anything fan, like you could take any game, you could change game systems. It's basically like, it's kind of how I always viewed, you know, the planes in the classic game of, mm-hmm. Oh, let's go try something different today. Or, hey, you know, Billy and Sarah didn't show up for a game night tonight, so we've got fewer players. All right, I'm going to take it. You're going to go through this rift or this gateway, and now we're in a different world. You're going to do this over here. So you've kind of got that built right in, and it's part of the fabric of what the whole narrative is from the get go. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, if you have a short group show up, if you're short players and you're running the traditional, the basic Iron Falcon 95, you can skip over the entire descending into the dungeon thing and just have whichever players you actually have be the ones who are on the spot when somebody has one of those unplanned transitions into monster form. I've seen many times a whole session go by with them never getting anywhere near the dungeon because what's going on in the town is interesting enough to keep them busy.
Right.
Between the nosy news girl and the cops who really are supposed to keep all this covered up. It gets interesting. Yeah. There's no reason why adventures, some of the more encapsulated adventures from, like, for instance, Iron Falcon Adventures 1, the Dungeon of Kairos or the Temple of Fear and Madness could easily be used as add-on adventures just by introducing an appropriate celestial anchor to get players in and out of the place. The basic thing for those listening, the basic thing here is there's two different ways that places were pushed out of the world can be connected to the world. One is through an overlay, a place where at certain times the magical area manifests, or a gateway to the magical area manifests, and the rest of the time you can't get there. It's just not there. A ruin that suddenly appears to be entirely intact, for instance, is an overlay, and then it goes back to being a ruin again, and the gateway is closed. The other way around is through the use of an object called a celestial anchor, where a place has become anchored to an object, and that object can be transported around the world, but it is possible to activate it and enter the place and where the magic is, which also tends to let the magic out of the object into the real world so that some magic works in the surrounding environment. Or you could break a celestial anchor, which is the premise of the initial adventure, and permanently anchor a place, some place it never was before, literally putting the dungeon in the basement of the hobby shop. Yeah. And so this, I deliberately structured it so that there are different ways that this can happen. So the game master can choose whatever way works for his or her campaign. If they're creating their own material, fit it in however they want to fit it in, make whatever explanation works for them. And it's all canon, basically.
Right, so this is all available now. Like you said, it's coming out just before Christmas. So this is a great, if you're a game master, which hopefully you are, if you were just listening to all this, great thing to pick up. If you completely cheated and you were like, you can't tell me what to do, I'm going to listen to the podcast anyway. buy it for your game master so they can run it for you. It's really cool. It's not expensive. It's very inexpensive, and easily to get. if you're like me and you buy everything on Amazon, it'll be there in like 2 days. So it's fantastic. But yeah, pick that up.
The Amazon production has gotten faster. The production of books from Amazon has gotten faster. Now, I don't know what Christmas is going to do to that. But people are already showing me books that they received, and I haven't gotten mine yet.
Well, when I ordered the handbook, it took literally less than 72 hours before it was from the time I hit the button until it was in my hand. The 75 I ordered yesterday. It should be here tomorrow, so that should be pretty good. And I also put in an order for something else I was going to mention. So we've gone through a bunch on Iron Falcon, and there's a bunch of cool stuff there that everybody should grab. There's also been some new stuff coming out for Basic Fantasy as well. And there was a question I was going to ask you about, because we talked about it briefly last time, and I went looking because I've been busy over the last month or so, and I haven't really been paying attention online as much as I could. Did I miss the competition that we discussed last time, or did that not?
I'm restructuring the competition. I had an idea. We had an idea. It was promoted on the Discord of doing a monster competition and then stacking an adventure competition on top of it. I'm less enamored of that idea as I was. It on one hand, it does sound kind of fun. I'm really not in a hurry to have a monster competition because God knows the monsters appear plenty fast enough without it. I don't feel like, much as I love to see new monsters, I don't feel like we really need to go out of our way to encourage more monsters. So I'm thinking it's going to just be an adventure competition. I haven't actually announced it yet, but I'm going to be putting it out there the 1st of January. We're going to have all of January to do another standard Basic Fantasy Stock My Dungeon adventure contest, except this time around, instead of having one dungeon to stock, I'm going to have an island. Laid out on a hex map with three encounter areas. The person writing the adventure will have to place the encounter areas where they want them, hex numbers that they want them in. So they won't all be in the same place with everybody's different adventures. The encounter areas are all going to be based on Dice and Logos maps, because why not?
Yep.
I was going to use one of his island maps, but I couldn't really make one work for me because none of them are really laid out on hexes the way I needed them to be. So I went ahead and did my own map there. And I wanted a smaller island anyway. But anyway, I got an island map. The writer will have to pick the hexes for their encounter areas, stock the encounter areas, and provide a random encounter chart for the island itself for whatever they think lives there. And basically just a kind of a hex crawl adventure for players to go out and, you know, find the dungeons and loot them for whatever reason. And every of course, an author who just presents dungeons for people to loot, it's not trying hard enough to win the competition. You need to have more story than that. I always say in the old school, we don't write story, but we do write backstory.
Yeah. Or you create situations.
Yes.
And create the situation and then see how the kids break your toys.
One of the things, digressing here a little bit, but one of the things that always bothered me about people who want to write a big story arc as an adventure, I like to write situations. I don't want to know how they're going to be resolved.
No, because
I want to see what happens.
Yeah, the best solutions are the ones that you're like, yeah, that makes sense. We're going to do that now.
When I wrote back in the BF2, Fortress Tomb and Tower, yeah. The Fortress of the Iron Duke adventure, the way that the evil artifact is contained in that adventure, I didn't write that. I ran the adventure without that part being done, and what my player characters came up with, that's what I put in. They came up with the idea. I said, that sounds good, and I wrote that down. So the canonical way of encapsulating the broken emerald with the demon inside it was come up with by my players. And I'm like, that sounds good. Sure.
Yeah. Some of the other new stuff that's coming with Basic Fantasy is there's been some updates to the Adventure Anthology #3. Is that coming up for print anytime soon? Or is that still in revisions before it would be?
We're not quite to final form for AA3 yet. Unfortunately, I'd like to be, but we're not. Same thing for the second field guide. We just keep creeping up closer to it, but we haven't quite gotten it finished yet.
But one that did come out on print though, that's coming with my Iron Falcon 75 is CS2 Dark Temple, that got released between the last time that we talked.
The second contest series. And that's, the primary impetus for me having another contest is that we finally got the second contest series book done. So it's time for another contest.
Right.
Get it started on a new one.
So yeah, so you're thinking that's going to launch right around beginning of the year. How long does it usually run for?
We typically go one month. Authors have a month to take our skeletal dungeon document and fill it in however they want to, and then we have a public vote. And so in February we'll have a public vote on the forum, probably allow a week for people to vote on it. And basically, forum members decide who the winner is. I do step in and cast a tie-breaking vote if there's a tie, but I always prefer if somebody wins organically, as it were.
Good stuff.
I did have to make the tie-breaking decision on CS2, but it just came down to two there, so it was pretty clear. I just had to pick between one of them.
All right, I've got a couple more quick-fire questions for you.
Sure, go for it.
I've got a episode coming up that I'm doing. So I did an episode ages ago where I was talking about what I thought the most powerful level one spell is from classic gaming. And I decided that I should do one for what the most powerful level, or what the most, if you were going to optimize which spell you could get, if you had your wish, what level two spell are you taking from the list of, you know, the common well-known level two spell options? What would you pick as your level two spell?
Invisibility, hands down.
Interesting.
Invisibility. Because if I'm playing a magic user and I get my choice of second level spell, I'm taking invisibility because there's nothing handier than being able to disappear at a convenient time.
Yeah, and it lasts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that was kind of my first thought too.
Now in basic fantasy, it's a 24-hour spell. It doesn't last indefinitely the way it does in other games. 24 hours or until you attack somebody or cast a spell.
Right.
But still, yeah, 24 hours is pretty good.
Yeah, it's interesting. I won't say which spell is coming in most common. So I put it out as a musing that, hey, I'm going to do an episode of this. And I had a bunch of people call in telling me what they thought. So that's why I figured I'd ask as well. It's been hilarious, the responses that have come in some ways very, very uniform of what the choice is, and other ways not. I won't say which one it is, but it surprisingly was not invisibility, which is what my initial gut reaction was too whenever I looked over them.
I'll look forward to finding the answer to that question.
Yeah, it'll be soon. The other thing that I've been doing after having spoken with you, I went on kind of a run of just interviewing a ton of different folks from gaming. And it's interesting enough. So coming up onto the end of the year, you look back at, you get all these retrospective, see your stats for this and blah, blah, blah. So I went back and just looked over what the top episodes were that people were listening to of the podcast, as you do. And so of the top five, two of them involve basic fantasy. One is my review of basic fantasy, and the other one was our conversation a month and a bit ago. So we'll see where this one cracks the top five too. But
wow, I am humbled. I am absolutely humbled.
But since the episode with you, I've been talking with a bunch of other folks, and I've been asking them all a question that I realized I don't think I asked you at the end. And it's fun for me. It's probably uncomfortable for everybody else, but it's great for me. And that is, you've done interviews and interacted with folks on the online a bunch, answering questions about everything to do with gaming and your games and what have you. But surely there has been something where you've sat down to talk to somebody, whether it be somebody like me or just in any sort of a Q&A, and you really hoped that somebody would ask you about something, or there was a topic that nobody ever brings up that you'd really like to lament about a little bit. So my question to you is, what have I not asked you either last time or this time that you're like, man, I wish Kevin would have asked me about this so I could talk about it a bit? Give me an excuse to.
There is absolutely nothing.
Oh, because come on.
I'll be honest with you, Kevin. If I have something I want to talk about and you don't ask about it, dude, I'm going to get it out there anyway. I'm just like that. Just because you didn't ask doesn't mean I don't have a license to say it. So
true.
No.
Is there something about Chris Gonerman or the different projects that you're working on that doesn't get talked about enough that you think people should hear about, that you'd like to take a moment to go, hey, this is something about me that maybe you don't know about, that's kind of cool? Or, well,
you know, I don't know that there is anything like that, because to be honest, I run a community. I mean, the Basic Fantasy Project is a community. And while I don't speak verbally in my own voice to people very often, pretty much every subject comes up at some point or another. We stay away from politics because that way lies madness, but and real world religion, the same reason. But pretty much every other topic, personal interests, other things I do besides role playing and so forth. Everybody, we run into it every now and then. There are things that have surprised me. I have run into a lot of people in RPGs who have at some time in the past been involved in model rocketry, but I can't find anybody in model rocketry groups that will admit to playing role-playing games. I don't understand how that works, because there's definitely an overlap, nerds and nerds, you know, but it, for whatever reason, that seems to be a thing.
Yeah, the overlap I've noticed over the last month or so that I've been talking to people is how much the overlap or the Venn diagram goes with people in education. So educators of whatever stripe, how many of them are also involved in gaming in some way, or how many people from gaming were at one point an educator. It's also a very huge crossover I've noticed.
The funny thing there is that you hear about educators. I know a lot of educators in real life, but the job group that has grown in my Facebook friends because of gaming is attorneys. I know more attorneys from RPGs than I do from law. Thank God, because that means I haven't been doing a lot of that stuff. But I mean, I've got. One of the old guys from the early days of TSR, Stephen Marsh, is on my friends list. I find him very, very interesting. I won't name the name, but there's another guy who is well known from Dragon's Foot, from creating advanced games back in the day, adventures back in the day, who is an attorney. And he and I have been friends for a long time. I can't say that we're real close friends, but I find pretty much everything he posts interesting. So there you go. And yeah, it's funny because that's not a career field that I really encounter a lot. I mean, I do have customers in my business who are attorneys, but I don't spend a lot of time with them. It's just, they're just customers, you know?
Yeah. One of the episodes I did earlier this week, which will probably be airing here early next week, was with the author of Low Fantasy Gaming, and he's a prosecutor in Australia.
Oh, so, God.
So yeah, the overlap is there. It's real.
Yep.
So I completely agree with you there.
Literal rules lawyers.
That's exactly the joke I made.
Oh, God.
So...
Did he file an objection with that one or what?
No, he didn't file an objection. He just very politely went, "Yes, I've heard that before."
Oh God!
And we moved on. But yes, I couldn't resist the low hanging fruit on that one either. But yeah, so there's lots of new books coming out, and new competitions for folks. Everybody's looking for a New Year's resolution. I've seen things of like Dungeon 23 where people are challenging each other to make dungeon rooms every day in the year of 2023. I think if you don't have one of these already going on, or even if you do, combine it and jump in on the competition for Basic Fantasy and see if you can get yourself in as the next big adventure that gets published in there. Pick up Iron Falcon 75. You've got Con Season will start up again in the new year. And Monster Books, because why not? Everybody loves Monster Books. Am I missing anything else? Is there anything else new that I should know about?
That pretty much covers it. I don't have anything else coming out for Iron Falcon for some time. Basic Fantasy Project produces prints when they're ready. We don't even know how to spell deadline. So, but I have every expectation that we'll probably get. I'm hoping for Field Guide 1 and 2 next year. I'm hoping for AA3 next year and maybe revisions of AA1 and 2 in print. But definitely want to see the field guides, the field guide 2 come out in print. And there's a revision of field guide 1 that we're working on. Quite a bit of tightening up of the text and so forth. So
awesome.
But yeah.
So folks, go and grab all the things. There'll be links in the show notes for it. Of course, basicfantasy.org, or you can go to the Iron Falcon website as well and get all the news.
Iron, IronFalconRPG.com.
Yeah, there's a news link at the top to keep you up to date. And there's, of course, where you really want to go is the forums, because that's where all the good stuff is happening, is in there as well. Chris, I thank you for coming back on. It was awesome to chat with you again. It's, you know, like I said, the audience obviously loves it, because of the top five, two of them in the top five are episodes either with you or all about the game that, well, that you help bring to the world.
Thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm going to send this to Future Me for editing, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, folks. That's going to wrap up this episode of the Red Caps Podcast. I hope you enjoyed, you learned something, and that you were eager to come back for more. www.theredcaps.net has all the links to all the ways to contact me, and I would love to hear from you. Thank you very so much for listening. Remember, never let your caps dry out. Stay safe. Have fun. We'll talk again soon. Happy holidays.